Welcome to the UNIS Union of Madison June meeting. Our speaker today is Declan Dolly, Vice President of the Effective UNIS UW Madison Group. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you.
All right. So thanks for having me today. I'm going to present on effective altruism, which is a global social movement focused on effectively doing good. I help run the local branch of effective altruism, or EA as we call it, in Madison. I would imagine that a lot of the people that are here, and the ideas that we're going to talk about are already things that you guys are pretty familiar with and have been thinking about for a long time. So I'm going to try to bear that in mind while going through this presentation and while doing my best to run an accurate presentation of EA. And because of the breadth of this whole topic, I'm not going to be able to cover every point in depth, in the depth that I would like to anyway. So hopefully we can discuss some of these topics further after the presentation and have a discussion about it. Here we go. Okay. So I'm going to start with a quote from Strangers Drowning that I think really sets the tone to talk about effective altruism. And it goes, "What do gooders lack is not happiness, but innocence. They lack that happy blindness that allows most people, most of the time, to shut their minds to what is unbearable. Do-gooders have forced themselves to know and to keep on knowing that everything they do affects other people, and that sometimes, though not always, their joy is purchased with other people's joy. Remembering that, they can no longer continue to live ignoring the unbearable. They feel an intense urge to dedicate their lives to help it. When there is so much suffering, injustice, and death, and when they continue to be for years to come, it can be overwhelming to think about the huge and complicated world we live in and what we can do to help." And so when I was a teenager, my mother took me with her on a 1-week trip to Haiti, where she worked at a school teaching veterinary medicine, as she's a veterinarian. And while she was doing that, I worked with an affiliated charity to distribute water filters in the rural villages surrounding the school in Mirebalais, which is a city in the Haiti ocean countryside. We drove out an old pickup truck every day with a group of other Americans. One of these trips for me was different from the others. As we did our usual work assembling water filters, an old man walked up to us and asked me, in English, "Why are you doing that?" Well, I didn't know how to respond, so he went on and saying something like, "Don't you see all these other people here watching you? Any of them could be putting these filters together. It's not hard. You're an American, and you came all this way to Haiti to do something any local child could do. Why is that?" Well, I couldn't answer him then, so I didn't. I knew the cost of my round-trip flight could have fed any family in that village for an entire year or financed hundreds of the water filters I was putting together. I honestly didn't know why I was there any more than he did. I couldn't answer, so instead, I laughed nervously and stepped behind a different American who was doing a task that any local child could do, in hopes that he would ask her instead. He simply started a speech in Haitian Creole addressing the people around us, and we went home early that day. I couldn't answer him then, but I can now. His unspoken point was right. I wasn't there to help those people. I was there for myself. Assembling filters was just what I did with my hands. I needed to learn from that trip and be galvanized into doing something that would be actually helpful in the future. If I didn't, it would be pointless. It didn't matter how many filters I put together. That man was angered by my ignorance and by how I thought I was getting something done. Really, I was just a placeholder for my future self. And he was right. Growing up, everyone learns the world can be a pretty messed up place. I learned that millions of people are already being harshly affected by climate change. I learned that about 1 in 10 people live on less than $1.90 per day. I learned that there are over 42 billion land animals that are leading miserable lives and are killed for food each year. I learned that over 2 million Americans are incarcerated, with incarceration rates being 6 times higher for Black Americans than White Americans. I learned, as we all have recently learned, of the threats posed by global outbreaks of disease, which have killed millions and endangered generations to come. It's easy to grow numb to statistics like these, so I think we should pause. Of course, we want to stay grounded in reasoning, so it's important that we look at statistics. We must remember that behind these numbers are real living beings who are experiencing real suffering. Stalin once said that a single death is a tragedy, but a million deaths is a statistic. that Stalin was wrong in a way we have to recognize. We're talking about people who with their own dreams, loved ones, and experiences. I wish I could ask you to take the feelings you have towards someone you know and scale them up 1,000,000 times. But we are literally incapable of feeling that level of caring in our minds, no matter how much we think we should be. We need to rely on our ability to think rationally if we want to respond adequately to these numbers. We simply can't process them on an intuitive level. I imagine that everyone in this room really cares about other people, and it's likely that your stomachs turn when you imagine the suffering around us. At least for me, it's incredibly overwhelming, and opening my mind to how much there is to do doesn't change the fact that I can only do so much. We are limited by our time, energy, money, work hours, and relationships. We simply can't do everything. And this is what intrigued me about effective altruism. An attempt to make up the most of our limited resources to tackle the world's most pressing problems. Bring about long-term, sustainable change and create a future we can be proud of. Effective altruism is a growing community and philosophy based on asking, how can we do the most good? Doing our best to figure it out and then acting accordingly. Many of us have been given immense privileges that we take for granted. How can we make the most of this of the opportunity we have been given to make the world a better place? This is a difficult and incredibly important question. That's why the general goal of many of the concepts of effective altruism is to provide a useful foundation for thinking about it. So I'll start off by discussing why it's important to prioritize between causes when deciding what to work on, donate to, or advocate for. And this is frequently called cause prioritization. The idea that we should actively compare different causes, figure out how much good we can do through each, and then mainly focus on the causes that, as best you can tell, offer better opportunities for doing good. And cause prioritization may seem crass, cold, or unfair. Surely, we might think, we don't want causes to get no support at all. Don't all causes deserve support? I think the emphasis here should be shifted. Causes don't deserve support, people do. Since some causes and interventions support people far more effectively than others, we need to prioritize those over other causes that we care about if we want to better support people. And an example might make this more clear. So suppose you have $1,000 that you want to donate and you're torn between two causes that you care about, helping fund screenings to detect lung cancer and funding insecticide-treated bug bed nets to protect children from malaria. What if you treated these causes equally and gave $500 each? Well, $500 is enough to scan about 2 people for lung cancer. On average, doing this gives people about 10 additional days of life. At the same time, $500 is enough to produce and distribute 50 bug nets. Each bug net protects 2 people, usually children under the age of 5, from getting malaria for about 3 years. So with $500, we can protect around 300 children for 3 years. On average, doing this gives people multiple additional years of life. This graphic shows how many people we can significantly support with a $500 donation to each of these causes. If we donate $500 to support lung scans, we could have bought malaria nets for 1,100 children. Then we are implicitly valuing supporting 2 people to some degree over supporting 100 people to a large degree. This is why supporting all causes equally is unfair. When we care about all people, we need to prioritize the most effective causes and interventions that allow us to best support people. Not because other causes aren't important, and not because they aren't really worth dedicating our lives to solving, but because our resources are limited. Donating to fund lung scans is an incredibly altruistic thing to do, but by choosing lung scans over bug nets, I am depriving hundreds of people of nets that can save their lives. I feverishly hope that one day we will be able to afford to work on smaller problems and that the larger problems will have all been solved. But right now, it would be unjust to do so if there's something better I can be doing. We should care about people and not causes, and we must prioritize the most effective interventions, because real people bear the cost of what we don't do. So it's important to prioritize between causes. How should we go about doing this? It is far from obvious what the best opportunities to support people are. The following example demonstrates just how hard it can be to tell what way of helping is most effective. So I'll give you a minute to think about which of these interventions increase school attendance the most per dollar spent in rural Kenya and rank them. And these interventions are unconditional cancer transfers to family, merit-based scholarships, informing people about the benefits of education, deworming, and providing free uniforms. And also think about how much more effective you think the best intervention is compared to the worst. And feel free to share and talk about your guesses to your neighbor if you'd like.
You could even add sanitary products for girls.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and that's another potential option that could be helpful. Isn't it?
Wow.
So I'll give you a moment to think about this and say, I guess maybe we can do like a show of hands.
How big a problem is warming?
Sorry?
How big a problem is warming? Is this something you need to know?
I guess which of these interventions increases school attendance the most?
Yeah, but I mean, you gotta, how big is a problem that kids are going to school?
Yeah, I guess that would be helpful information. I think what this is measuring is how many additional days of schooling will providing each of these services help children increase school attendance. So how many additional days of school attendance will some of each of these factors? And actually, I have a graph for this. Like this. So the worst two performers were unconditional cash transfers and merit-based scholarships. And free uniforms were about twice as effective as merit-based scholarships. And deworming, providing medication to remove gastrointestinal worms from students, was about 20 times as effective as free uniforms. And informing parents about the benefits of education was about 50% more effective than deworming.
Probably
less costly,
too.
Yeah, well, I think this is all controlled for the same, for $100
spent. Oh, okay.
So I give this example to show just how hard it can be to determine what will work and what won't if we go with our guts. And this is why it's so important to use evidence and careful reasoning when we decide what work to donate to, what to work on and to donate to. So, yeah, taking an evidence-based approach to do-gooding is a simple but powerful idea. For whatever reason, there isn't a strong tradition of evidence-based reasoning in philanthropy. For example, very few charities advertise what they can do with your money. When I donate $10 to a shelter, there's an implicit assumption that my money is going to help animals, but which animals and how many? Donating to many charities is like going to a grocery store and handing the clerk a $10 bill without knowing how many groceries you'll get back or what. It's clearly ridiculous. So to remedy this, effective altruists created websites such as GiveWell, which rigorously calculates the cost effectiveness of different charities. And upon doing this, they came to the starting conclusion that the best charities are 100 times more effective than the average charities when using measurements such as quality-adjusted life years, which is a measurement of years of perfect health gained from a charitable intervention. So this means that donating $1 to the best charities is doing as much good as $100 to the average charities. This is the power of evidence-based reasoning when trying to do good. So GiveWell and other organizations prove that our intuition alone is not good enough. This is in part because our intuitions are heavily influenced by what problems are most visible to us. But many of the worst injustices in the world are suffered silently and distantly. We need to look for them if we want to help end them. Our intuitions are often blind to the distance and scale of problems, but the world's problems know no such boundaries. So another reason to be skeptical towards our intuitions is that while our intuitions are great for many things, they're terrible at dealing with numbers, especially large numbers. A problem that affects thousands of people might feel similar to one that affects billions, but between them, there is a world of difference. So to find better opportunities to help, we cannot simply rely on our intuitions. Oh, this next slide as well. We need to look for, explicitly consider factors that make certain causes better or worse opportunities to help. So what are some of these? Three factors that are especially useful for identifying the best opportunities to help are scale, neglectedness, and solvability. So scale refers to the number of people affected by an issue and how severely they're affected. We see comparisons from for interventions within a cause area earlier, but we can also compare between different causes. So consider the problem of climate change in comparison to ALS, the disease. So climate change is estimated to cause about 150,000 deaths per year and is likely to kill millions more in coming years, displacing more than 100 million individuals by 2050. In contrast, ALS is expected to kill roughly 180,000 people by 2050. So when it comes to scale, how many are affected and how severely, climate change is a more important issue than ALS. Not because ALS isn't important. ALS causes patients and their loved ones to suffer greatly, and I know this. But because our world has many more tragedies than we have lifetimes to address, and we must prioritize larger problems. So another factor to consider is solvability, which is sometimes called tractability. And this refers to how much of the problem we can expect to solve and how easily. So as we saw earlier, it's much more tractable to prevent people from contracting malaria than to protect people from lung cancer. Offering people bed nuts is much easier than performing expensive scans and treatments. And a third, especially important factor to consider is neglectedness. How many resources, funding, careers, research, media coverage, et cetera, are already going into an issue? Highly neglected causes are often better opportunities for impact due to diminishing returns. If a cause has only 100 people working on it, there's probably much more low-hanging fruit, untapped opportunities to help, than a cause with thousands of people and billions of funding have already been made use of the best opportunities to help. One additional person can make a much greater difference through a neglected cause than through an already saturated one. So consider the issue of farmed animal welfare. There are 72 billion farmed land animals and another 1.2 trillion aquatic animals that are killed for food each year. In the US, for every human, there are 28 land animals raised and killed in factory farms for each year, and they are subject to cruel treatment throughout their lives. Still, only 3% of philanthropic funding in the US goes to animal-based causes. And even among that, less than 3% goes towards non-human animals. Less than 3% that goes towards non-human animals, most of the money goes towards shelters, while many, many more animals are mistreated in factory farms. So farmed animals are vastly more neglected than both pet animals and humans, while they are mistreated on a much larger scale. So you may be noticing a trend here. Neglected causes often look pretty weird. So by definition, neglected causes are the ones that not a lot of people are talking about, and they often aim at improving the well-being of people or beings who aren't usually given attention, such as people halfway across the world living in extreme poverty, farmed animals, and different generations. So when an idea about improving the world is unintuitive or weird, it can be especially important to take it seriously because no one else will. On top of this framework for comparing causes, what are other considerations that help us to do it better? So one of the most important lessons I've learned from effective altruism is to expand my compassion and think really hard about what we ought to care about. So by definition, or by default anyway, most people care and spend most of their time thinking about ourselves, our friends, and our family. Many of us also advocate for causes benefiting our local communities, communities we identify with, and community identities we hold in our country. But do the lives of people living halfway across the world of a different race, nationality, or religion matter any less than those of people who people within our conventional boundaries. So Peter Singer, who is a contemporary effective altruist philosopher, famously poses the drowning child thought experiment, in which he asks, if you would save a child drowning in a pond in front of you, even if it would ruin $1,000 suit and pair of shoes, and cause you to run late for your interview. He then asks you to identify the relevant, oh, we have this picture of this as well. So we then ask you to identify the relevant moral difference between the child drowning in front of you or halfway across the world. As he and I see it, there isn't one. If I would lose $1,000 in property to save a child in front of me, it would be silly not to spend $1,000 to save a child across the world. When we include all humans in our circle of caring, we realize that in comparison to local issues, many global issues affect many more people and more severely and are much easier to address. And similarly, are humans the only species that are worthy of moral concern, or beings whose suffering and well-being matter? When we include tens of billions of land animals, we include tens of billions of animals or more in our circle of caring, we see how large and neglected animal welfare concerns are. And even if we're unsure of the moral relevance of non-human animals, it might make sense to hedge our bets by investing in their well-being, especially when hundreds of thousands of them can be saved for the same cost as saving a single human. And lastly, how should we think about the well-being of future generations, who will have to deal with the consequences of our society's choices, but have no say in political decision-making that will impact their quality of life, or even their likelihood of existence? It's for these reasons that global poverty, animal welfare, and improving the long-term future are such high priority causes within effective altruism to a lot of people. So I'll briefly narrow in on the idea of long-termism, which is a concept of considering the long-term expected impact of a given action in terms of morality. Although unintuitive, it's a cause many EAs, many effective altruists care about a lot. So this is for two reasons. First, future humans are morally important, since the circumstances of people's birth, including when they were born, shouldn't lessen their importance. For example, we can be fairly confident in about how many people will be born in the next 10 years and take steps to improve their lives, even though we don't know exactly whose lives we're improving. Because on average, we can expect that they will be people we want to help. And the same can be said for people who we expect to live in 100 or 1,000 years. And second, there can easily be an immense number of people in the future. So I'll elaborate on the second point a little bit. If each person in this graphic represents about 10 billion people, humanity has been around, had around 100 billion people who have lived before us in the past, and roughly 10 billion people alive today, roughly. But when we think about the number of people that could exist in the future if humanity survives and flourishes, kind of sensational, I suppose. So the point here is the number could very well be way, way beyond what we can comprehend. And a world-ending catastrophe like nuclear war or a pandemic makes it impossible for all of those future people to ever exist. And this is why, for many effective altruists, a central priority is improving the long-term future. With such a fantastic number of lives at stake, even minutely decreasing the likelihood of extinction risk is an incredibly good thing to do, because it preserves a future for trillions of humans. This is why many effective altruists care so much about highly neglected extinction risks, like bioengineered pandemics and the risks of artificial intelligence. Okay, so next I'm going to talk about some other concerns that you may find helpful for increasing impact, or that may be helpful. So, as many of us are Americans and consume primarily American media, it can be easy to forget about issues outside of the US. However, on a global scale, even poor Americans tend to be far better off than many people elsewhere in the world. The median American household income per person is $33,000, which puts us comfortably in the top 10% of the global income distribution, while the median US top university graduate's income puts us in the global top 1%. We are the top 10 or 1%. which means we have a really, really big opportunity to help the other 99. Our time and money are limited, so effective altruism's project, a project I invite anyone to join, is figuring out how we can most effectively use this opportunity to improve the world. So, and I have this, I'll give an example of this, of what this could look like, I guess just an example, from my student group. So, I guess I'll point out the top there is the American Red Cross. So, in my sophomore year of college, before I learned about effective altruism, I donated platelets almost every week and blood every 8 weeks at the Red Cross. And I did this in order to help people and save lives. That was my goal. But as I learned more about donation-constrained charities and highly effective, scalable interventions in the third world, I stopped donating platelets and blood. And instead, I started going to a for-profit plasma donation center that just paid, that was for-profit and paid the donors for their blood components, and donated the money I earned from that to the SCI Foundation, pictured there, which is the charity that treats Kenyan and other East African children for parasitic worm infections. And we referenced it earlier, actually. So this is just a bunch of details about this, about why I found that to be a good idea. But in short, I estimated it to be a significantly better use of resources, in this case, physically, my blood, than donating my blood components directly. And so I started a program at my school last year for students to donate blood in order to donate more in this way. And this has resulted in thousands of dollars being donated to charities like SCI, the Against Malaria Foundation, which we also referenced earlier, and GiveDirectly, among many, many others. So, when all these ideas are internalized, quite a few people have felt a strong urge to devote all of their time, money, all of their time and money to giving support to those who desperately need it. But we know that this is not a sustainable approach from a physical and mental health perspective, as well as from an efficiency perspective. From the testimonials of people who have tried, being really hard on yourself to the point of burning out can make it much harder for you to help people over the long term. So rather than an obligation, I prefer to see effective altruism and opportunities to do good as an amazing opportunity to help. And one more about that. There is also a common mental health myth that surrounds rational do-good in this way. So, and that is that there is a fundamental contrast between your head and your heart, or in other words, the empathetic and logical parts of yourself. To be a rational do-gooder, you will always have to fight against what you feel and what you really want, against what you feel and what you really want. And that's not true, in a way that effective altruists frequently find themselves grappling with. Emotions can be tuned to fit more accurately with reality, and likewise, it would be irrational to ignore emotional impulses. This is not a dichotomy between those two things. And to clarify another idea, quickly, effective altruist is a shorthand for someone who is trying to be good, to be effective at altruism. We still have so much to learn, and individually and collectively, and being modest about our lack of knowledge is key to doing so. We sometimes fall short of how we want to live, but that isn't the reason to abandon our ideals. It's why we need them. What is important is that we keep learning, growing, and continually looking for even better opportunities to improve the world. Okay. So to quickly recap what we've gone over, it's important to prioritize between different causes and determine which ones have the largest impact. One helpful framework for doing this is comparing problems along the dimensions of scale, neglectedness, and solvability. We discussed expanding our circle of compassion to people all over the world, to animals and future generations. And to finish up, we'll discuss some more concrete actions that we take to apply this information and lessons in our lives. So, first here, in recognition of the fact that the most impact of our business decisions we will make is probably how we spend approximately 80,000 of our working lives. I mentioned that now. effective altruists have created the organization such as 80,000 Hours, which conducts research to find out which careers have the largest positive social impact on average and provides career advice based on that research. Okay. Along with career choice, another high impact decision is how we donate our money. My choices about where we donate our money and how we engage our friends, family, and network to donate can have a lot of impact. According to a study by the Founders Pledge, donations to the most effective climate charities are drastically more effective at reducing carbon emissions than other more popular interventions, such as changing our consumption habits. So instead, a donation of $105 to a highly effective climate charities reduces the carbon in the atmosphere by the same amount that a typical American generates in 1 year. And I can get into this later because it's a bit more complicated than that. But so, and finally, one other thing that that a lot of people in the effective altruism community, including especially my student group, is really into learning about collective problems and what we can do about them is of utmost priority. And at every event my student group holds, we distribute free copies of books like Doing Good Better, pictured here, which is a more in-depth exploration of effective altruism and various concepts about doing good. And The Precipice, which is about long-termism and the long-term future and what we should be doing about that. So raising awareness of effective do-gooding, and by extension, particularly large, tractable, and neglected problems, is probably one of the most effective things we can do to solve these problems. All right. And the world we live in, is an extremely bizarre state, where people in the first world have the ability to impact and improve an insane amount of lives through relatively minor decisions. And even putting that aside, we also reside in a critical century where humanity stands on a precipice, with risks of both falling into extinction and reaching unknown heights. When we recognize this, we might feel overwhelmed. For me, joining the effective altruism community helped me turn my paralysis into resolve. I have found getting involved with the community to be deeply empowering, and I hope that you do too, because every day there are strangers drowning, and every day you have the opportunity to reach out to them. And that's this. I have a bunch of references from all the studies and whatnot said in here. There we go, so thanks so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Questions from the audience?
Wow. You're a university guy. Are you getting this from any of your coursework?
Not to the extent that I would like. And actually, university advocacy to professors to increase a lot of the knowledge spreading of more knowledge about how to effectively do good is something that we are, as a student group, are getting more involved in. And that's something we want to help too. And I do know that at other student groups, they have gotten specific courses dedicated to some things we've talked about, statistic. I know Stanford, the effective altruism group at Stanford University got something, at some sort of statistics in altruism course like that to help teach more people about these issues and how to more effectively solve them. So yeah.
So your group believes in enlightenment and logic and
I wouldn't say it's not by ourselves anyway.
I mean, it's so different from the messages we're getting from the social justice or at universities, where feelings are what matter, and white guilt.
And I will say feelings.
This is encouraging. Is what I'm trying to say.
Thanks. And feelings do matter, of course. Like I don't. And this is something I think about a lot. We grapple with a lot. Feelings do matter.
We want to keep them
totally into account. But yeah,
you don't
paying attention to
feelings.
You can't run a movement just on feelings, eh?
Yeah, and knowing caring more about what's effective. For instance, it seems to me that if you want to get rid of racial disparities, you've got to start in the beginning with kids to to be successful, they have to learn to read. And our education schools consistently poo-poo phonics, which is the very thing that helps kids learn to read in homes that don't have books and don't encourage reading and don't have an early exposure to reading. You know, that's such a simple thing. But the education school is too worried about being called groomers.
Mm-hmm. So maybe that's like, so in other words, maybe that's what we should be focusing on to help solve a lot of the like racial like inequality and injustice issues, the border issue, be perhaps significant a little bit. And I do know people that are doing research on things like that to figure out what sort of policy changes would probably have positive effects in that direction.
How long has your student group been in existence?
About a year and a half. It's not very old. Effective altruism, the effective altruism movement, at least under that name, because I'm sure people have been talking about things like this for generations, but at least under this name is about 12 or 13 years old, I think. And so we're a bit later. We're one of the more new student groups in the general community of effective altruists, or people who decide to call themselves, which is again anyone who feels like that.
I'm glad to see you mention the GiveWell website, which is a good resource for people to go to if they want to know how effective their contributions are.
Yeah,
is the Center for Effective Altruism the first? Did that lead to the formation of the campus groups, or is that?
Oh, and that's actually interesting. So effective altruism as a movement is not centralized around the Center for Effective Altruism, which is a bit misleading. There's a lot of different effective altruism organizations, probably some of the largest ones are the Center for Effective Altruism and GiveWell, and I also mentioned 80,000 Hours a few slides back. Some of the largest three anyway. The Center for Effective Altruism does a lot of like funding and organization for student groups and helps make that happen. We've had contacts with them, but we also have contacts with several other organizations, including Open Philanthropy, which is another one of this list. But yeah, I especially recommend people who are interested in looking about how to especially do good, a lot of good with their money, I would definitely recommend looking to GiveWell. That's what I'm working on.
So are you familiar with the donut economics?
Sorry?
Are you familiar with donut economics?
Donut economics. I might need a refresher.
Okay. Yeah. But I mean, the idea being that there's a sweet spot, you know, that you can go too far. The environment and also social justice kind of things that we need to, economics 101 is, I'm not a economist, I'm sorry, but it made sense to me when I read it, and now but it seems to affecting economic policy is basically what she's saying. That you got to take into concern the environment and social welfare as well as just the GDP.
I will fault myself for having a lot of simplified examples of this.
I mean, she does a TED talk. I mean, book a TED talk and go into economics, so she can do that. Yeah. A better explanation than I do, but it seems to fit with this.
Totally. We're considering those factors as well. Yeah.
Any other questions?
I'm encouraged.
Thanks.
Yeah, to see a young person. logical, sensible.
Drop by University of Wisconsin-Madison and you'll see several more. Many, many more.
Well, I wish.
You know how many campus groups there are in existence now?
In the world? So it's sort of interesting because it's not necessarily clear to me how profound effective altruism is. And I would imagine there's a lot of groups in the world that are have similar ideas but don't use the same name, right? Because I think a lot of people really resonate with this, with the ideas of this, right? But so all I can really speak of is effective altruism groups. But of those, last I checked, I think there was around 200 or 300 student groups in the world. So it's not huge. It's certainly not every university in the US. And so, yeah, expanding to more universities is something that we definitely want to do. Yeah, and other cities and whatnot. Because there's also many city groups. And there used to be a city group in Madison, actually, not associated with the city. Maybe that could become a thing again.
Well, thank you very much for coming and making
it. Thanks so much.